given the events of this last week, I thought that I might ought to use James 4 and verse 8 as a beginning point this morning, which in Brother Perry's King James says, "Wash your hands." Yeah, that joke is being made all over the U.S. and pulpits everywhere, isn't it, this morning? Before we begin the lesson, I would like to turn your attention for just a moment to the book of Hebrews and the second chapter and the 15th verse, where the text there indicates that through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, we have been freed from the subjection and slavery of the fear of death. As we contemplate this last week and the week before and the weeks that are ahead, precaution is one thing. Pandemonium and panic is yet quite another thing. So I would urge you to reflect on this verse in the days and the weeks ahead, and remember not only who we are supposed to be as children of God, freed from the slavery and subjection not only to sin but also to death and the fear of it. Remember also what we are supposed to be and our example to those who are around about us. Now, with those things out of the way, I will tell you that I began preparations for this particular sermon before all this corona stuff came around. Had no thought of such things in my mind when I thought of and began working on this particular topic. But if you would turn your attention to 1 Samuel, the 15th chapter, and we're going to allow you at least to look at that text. We're not going to read it. It's a fairly familiar story. Allow that text to serve as somewhat of an introduction to the things that I'd like us to consider this morning. Why are we so prone to view ourselves as and to act like victims? Last week I read from a satirical source that Harvard University was now offering a 4-year degree on feeling oppressed. That's a joke. It's not serious. But the thing that makes it somewhat humorous is that kernel of truth, that nugget of reality that is embedded in the notion that a prestigious university could offer a 4-year degree plan on how you feel. Not too far from the truth. We have become, in many ways, victimologists. We can see ourselves or find victims in just about any scenario or situation which we might encounter. Why is that? I think it's more often than not, at least that in and from our own perspectives, being a victim means that whatever is wrong or whatever has failed in this situation is not my fault. If I'm a victim, I'm not the one responsible. This is not my fault if I'm a victim. The sad reality is that it is usually exactly my fault. Even though I may present myself, even though I may view myself as being a victim, it's usually my fault. Maybe I'm speaking more for me than for anyone else in these regards. But as you think about 1 Samuel chapter 15, understand this is not a new phenomenon. Here in 1 Samuel 15, the directions were fairly clear as given to King Saul in verses 1 through 3. Go and utterly destroy the Amalekites. Everything basically that breathes, kill it. In verses 4 through 8 of the text, you see that for the most part, he did fairly well. But somewhere along the way, the wheels fell off of Saul's resolve. The wheels fell off of his leadership. And the wheels fell off of his obedience. Down in verses 9 through 15, it's one of my favorite verses. Saul comes out and says, "Blessed are you, Samuel of the Lord. I've obeyed the Lord's voice." And Samuel says, and you can almost see him putting that ear up, that hand up to his ear, can't you? That, "Why do I hear sheep bleating? If you did what God said, why do I hear sheep?" So Saul, first of all, in verse 13, pretends that nothing is wrong. But when it is pointed out to him by Samuel that something, actually is wrong, then what does he do? In the first part of verse 15, the first thing is he blames the people. The next thing he does in the latter part of verse 15 is tries to minimize his failure by maximizing his partial obedience. That's also known as accentuating the positive in more modern vernacular. But Samuel in verses 16 down through verse 19 makes it clear that neither he, Samuel, nor God was having any of this from Saul. In verse 20 of your text, notice that Saul then doubles down, so to speak, on the fact that he had obeyed, partial as it may have been. And then he also doubles down in verse 21 on shifting the blame for all of these things to the people. In verses 22 and 23, it's apparent God nor Samuel is still not buying this. They're not taking this victimology and this presenting of himself as a victim that Saul is putting forth. In the first part of verse 24, he finally admits his failure. Look at the text there. "Then Saul said to Samuel, 'I have sinned. I have indeed transgressed the command of the Lord and your words.'" What's the next word in your text? "Because I feared the people and listened to their voice." What does that mean? Well, I messed up. But I'm the victim here. It's not my fault. I was afraid of the people. You're their king. You're head and shoulders taller than any of them. That's one of the reasons they picked you. Well, God picked him. But they're one of the reasons they were so willing to follow him. Because he was a big man. I feared the people. You're supposed to be their king. Do you see how Saul is here playing this victim card? Even in verse 30 of your text, after admitting his defeat, he says, but can you help me save some face here? Go with me, Samuel, so the people don't look at me any differently. Help me save face. What we're seeing in this is Saul playing the victim all the way through 1 Samuel 15 down to verse 30. And I think there are lessons to be learned there, but I don't want to spend our time in this particular text specifically this morning. We're going to look at some other texts. Again, mostly for the most part, texts that are familiar to you. That we're not going to have to look real closely at the texts themselves in order to draw out points from them that I think are worthy of our consideration. The first question that I have is, are we really that different from Saul when we today see and portray ourselves to others and also to God as being victims? Don't we often view and present ourselves as victims in similar ways and for much the same reasons as Saul did? He didn't want to face accountability for his failure. I thought about this, and I thought about ways in which we see
or portray ourselves as victims with regard to their motivations, maybe? No, not really motivations. More so how we do it. Let me explain it this way. In what way do we present ourselves or see ourselves as victims? First thing that came to mind was genetics. We do that. I'm just the way that I am, or God made me this way, thus I can't help myself. Now, I'm not talking about transgender and gender dysphoria. That has a place in this discussion, perhaps, but that's not what I mean. Our audience this morning is not really having problems with that kind of victimology. Rather, what we do is, I know I shouldn't have said that, but I inherited a bad temper from my mother, from my father, from my Irish redheaded grandmother, whatever. What are we really doing except excusing ourselves on the basis of our ancestry? We're saying, I know I shouldn't have done that, just like Saul did, and then adding, just like Saul did, because, and then we insert the reason of our ancestry, our race, our nationality, all of those kind of things that are tied to our genetics. In Exodus, the fourth chapter in verse 10, God has appeared to Moses in a burning bush in the wilderness of Midian and has given him a specific charge that he's got a job for him to go to Egypt and to tell Pharaoh to let my people go. Do you remember what Moses says to him in that text? Well, he says a lot. It's amazing to me that throughout the better part of a chapter and a half here, we have this discussion between God and Moses recorded for us. And one of the things in that text that Moses says has to do with exactly what we're talking about. In Exodus, the fourth chapter in verse 10, Moses says to the Lord, "Please, Lord, I have never been eloquent, neither recently nor in times past, nor since thou hast spoken to thy servant, for I am slow of speech and slow of tongue." Now, that's not exactly making a genetic argument. But what is he saying? This is who I am, God. I can't help that I'm this way, which is in effect the same as a genetic argument. He forgot one thing. To whom he was speaking. Did God not know everything there was to know about Moses? From the beginning, and even before his conception, did God not know this man and what capabilities and what limitations were present within him? Furthermore, did God not have the ability to assist Moses in any way that he saw fit so that Moses' questioning of God's choice of him for this particular mission is an indictment not only of the omniscience of God, but also of His power? So think about it for just a moment. God already knew and has already selected him for this job. God would make provisions for it. He does so in the verses following down from verses 14 down through about verse 17, where he says, "Okay, take Aaron with you." But God is going to be the power here. God is going to give him not only the words, but also someone to speak them. God would help him overcome or outgrow this. So that in Deuteronomy, the 31st chapter, we see a song talked about that Moses writes. And let me ask you one more question from Deuteronomy 31 as well. Who wrote the first five books of the law? A man who said he was slow of speech would say, wait a minute, he's writing. Well, he also said he wasn't eloquent. And yet the first five books of God's law, with the exception of the part that records Moses' death, of course, were written by this man. So when we start to think of ourselves as victims of our genetics, think back to Moses for just a moment. We cannot help and we cannot change our genetics or what we have inherited, such as genetic predispositions with their strengths or their weaknesses. But God knows that already. Ezekiel, the 18th chapter, tells us that we do not inherit sin from our forefathers. The son doesn't bear the sins of the father, neither the father of the son. But the righteousness of the righteous is upon him, and the wickedness of the wicked is upon him. So our genetics don't make us a victim. In Ephesians, in the book of Ephesians, in the third chapter, let me just close this point out by reading for you or with you. I prefer the latter. From Ephesians 3, a prayer that Paul has and apparently continued to have for the Ephesians. He says in verse 14, I bow my knees before the Father. He's praying for the Ephesians that he would grant you, verse 16, according to the riches of his glory, to be strengthened with power through the Spirit in the inner man. Question. Can God fulfill that prayer regardless of your genetics? Verse 17. So that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, that you, being rooted and grounded in love, may be able to comprehend with all the saints what is the breadth and the length and the height and the depth, and to know the love of Christ which surpasses all knowledge. Can we know that? Yeah. Our genetics don't prevent us from understanding exactly what Paul is praying for with regard to the Ephesians, or praying for and receiving the same things ourselves. The latter part of verse 19, that you may be filled up to all the fullness of God. Now him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly beyond all that we ask or think. He's stacking up superlatives here. Exceedingly abundantly above all that we could ask or think. That's the power of the God that we serve. According to the power that works where? In us. All of that power of God, all that love of Christ is manifested in and through us. Within us, the latter part of verse 20 says, to him be the glory in the church in Christ Jesus to all generations forever and ever. So when we read this passage, do we really feel good about saying, well, I just can't help the way that I am. I was born this way. My family's all like this. You're part of God's family. The recipient of Christ. Boundless love. One through whom God's power, infinite power, which is abundantly above all that we ask or think, exceedingly so, it's manifested in and through you. You're not a victim of your genetics. Secondly, sometimes we see ourselves as victims of chance. I was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. You know, that statement bothers me a little bit, perhaps more than it should. But my mind thinks about that statement and says, is there really a right time to be in a wrong place? If there's a wrong place, predicated on her statement, I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. If it's a wrong place, is there ever a right time for me to be there? If I stay out of the wrong places, then I don't have to really be concerned about what time it is, do I? In 2 Samuel, there's another familiar story, that of David's sin with Bathsheba. And part of that story that we sometimes overlook is the first few verses of 2 Samuel chapter 11. Look with me for just a moment. We're again not going to read this. But notice the first verse, how all of this begins. In 2 Samuel chapter 11 and verse 1, "Then it happened in the spring, at the time when kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the sons of Ammon and besieged Rabbah, but David stayed at Jerusalem." Now, what's the first thing that we learn from this text? It was the time of the year when kings go out to battle. Did this king go out to battle? No. He sent Joab. He sent Joab's commanders and underlings and all the army and Israel out, but he stayed behind. He was in the wrong place. So while we can look at this story and say there wasn't anything wrong with David being on his roof or looking out and even happening to see a woman who was bathing, that may all be true, but the fact remains, the problem here is David's not a victim of chance. He shouldn't have been where he was. But that's not the real problem. Because even though David wasn't where he should have been, even though he was on his rooftop looking out over and saw a woman that was not clothed perhaps as she should have been, or maybe was thinking she was more private than she was, all that had to happen was for David to turn away. But you know this story. That's not what he did. He looked, and then he asked, and then he sent for her. Now, process this with me for just a moment with regard to us thinking that we are victims of chance. David's sin and the ultimate death of not only her husband, Uzzah, the not only the death of her husband, but also the child, that wasn't a matter of chance. David wasn't just in the wrong place at the wrong time and therefore a victim of chance. He did the wrong thing. He looked apparently repeatedly. He asked and he sent for, and then he took and lay. Think about ourselves. Our failures are just that. They are ours to own and to wear. David eventually was brought to his sin and said, "I have sinned." He didn't do like Saul. He didn't try to shift the blame. He didn't try to, excuse himself. But what I'm wanting you to see here is David's not a victim of chance. And neither are we. Look in James, the first chapter, for just a moment. And let's be clear about where our spiritual failures come from. In James chapter 1, verse 14, "Each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust." Chance was not the problem for David. It's not the problem for you and I. It's those lustful desires, excessive, inordinate desires, whether they be sexual, as was the case with David, or more general, as is the case here. "Each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. Then when lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death." You can write David and Bathsheba in the margin here, can't you? And see how these two verses play out in 2 Samuel chapter 11. Now,
We don't need to deceive ourselves about these things. So James says in James chapter 1 and verse 16, apparently through the Holy Spirit's inspiration, prophesying how we might react to that, he says, don't be deceived about this. That's a phrase that's repeated often in the New Testament, 4, 5, 6 times at least. And in every case, when he says, do not be deceived, it's a very simple statement about which most of us would say, yeah, that's true, unless it's about me. My circumstance is different. I was just a victim of chance. I just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. I didn't really do anything wrong. He says, don't be deceived about the source of sin. Each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. That's true for you. That's true for me. That's true in sexual ways. That's true in non-sexual ways. Whatever it is for which we may have an excessive, inordinate, improper desire, whether it's wealth, whether it's health, if our desires are excessive, they're going to lead us into sin. Not a matter of chance. Yes, there are things that happen to us that are truly accidents of chance. And those are beyond our ability to control or even influence. But more often than not, the things that we can control but don't control are much more of a problem than the ones that we truly cannot control. Either way, we have to make a choice. And that choice is clear. Are we going to retreat to victimhood or move forward in and through the victory, through faith to the victory that Christ has promised? Do you remember Matthew, the 6th chapter, verses 25 through 39 down there? Dave cited verse 24 in Bible class this morning, where we can't serve God and mammon. But Jesus goes on in that same text to talk about the birds of the air, the lilies of the field. They don't worry about what they wear. They don't worry about what they eat. And he said, on down in that text, which of you by being anxious can add a single cubit to his lifespan? What he's saying is these things are ultimately beyond our control. Don't worry yourselves about those things which you cannot control. Worry about those things and concern yourselves with those things which you can control by seeking first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, verse 33. Then whatever may or may not happen to us by way of chance, we're prepared for it. We're not going to create victimhood in ourselves or portray ourselves as victims of those kinds of things. Thirdly, as I think about this, we present ourselves as victims of circumstances. It's very much akin to chance, but slightly different. How do we present ourselves as victims of circumstance? Well, it's the best that I could do under the circumstances. I just chose the lesser of evils. What have we just done? We have salved our conscience that it really wasn't our fault because we didn't have any good options available to us. We didn't have any right choices to make here. We just had to choose the best of the wrong ones. Is that really the case? Again, perhaps a familiar example to you from the Old Testament. Go back to 1 Samuel and again to Saul, this time in 1 Samuel chapter 13. In 1 Samuel the 13th chapter, and I've got to tell you, to understand what's going on here in 1 Samuel 13, you really need one verse from chapter 10. Go back there for just a moment to 1 Samuel 10 verse 8. Samuel has appointed Saul, the new king of Israel, has anointed him so. In verse 8, he says, and you shall go down, Samuel speaking to Saul,
from the mouth of God, apparently, "You shall go down before me to Gilgal, and behold, I will come down to you and offer burnt offerings and will sacrifice peace offerings. You shall wait 7 days until I come to you and show you what you should do." So Saul has been given instructions. The Philistines are amassing in chapter 13 and before against Israel. They've got an overwhelming army. Israel is relatively small, but Saul has assembled them. He's mustered the troops here, and he has gone to Gilgal as Samuel has told him. He's waited 7 days as Samuel instructed. Verse 8 of 1 Samuel 13, "He waited 7 days according to the appointed time set by Samuel, but Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattering before him, or from him. Saul said, 'Bring me the burnt offering and the peace offerings,' and he offered the burnt offering." Seeing a problem here? "And it came about as soon as he finished offering the burnt offering that, behold, Samuel came, and Saul went out to meet him and to greet him. And Samuel said, 'What have you done?'" Now this is before what we read earlier in chapter 15, obviously. But there are some remarkable similarities. In chapter 15, when Samuel comes and says, "What have you done?" it's the second time this has occurred. Because here's the first one. So Samuel shows up and says, "What have you done?" Notice Saul's answer. Saul said, verse 11 of 1 Samuel 13, "Because I saw that the people were scattering from me, that you did not come within the appointed days, and that the Philistines were assembling at Michmash." Three things he lays out. "I saw the people were scattering. You didn't show up. And the army was getting bigger on the other side. Therefore," verse 12, "I said, 'Now the Philistines will come against me at Gilgal, and I have not asked the favor of the Lord.'" You see, I had good intentions. Okay. Remember that saying about the path to hell being paved with good intentions? It's exactly what Saul is saying here. "I had good intentions, but I have not asked the favor of the Lord, so I forced myself and offered the burnt offering." What has Saul just said? "I didn't have any good choices here. The offering needed to be made. The people were scattering. You weren't here. The army on the other side was getting bigger and about to charge. I had to do something. This is what I did." Sound familiar? Or even more frightening, does it sound plausible? Are we making the same kinds of choices? Presenting ourselves as victims of our circumstances. Samuel's not having it. Verse 13, "You have acted foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not endure. The Lord has already replaced you," basically. Circumstances. "It was the best I could do under the circumstances." What's the lesson for us? One really passage I think is all that is necessary. Look with me to 1 Corinthians, the 10th chapter. Let me explain something or remind you of something I've explained previously. I think it's vitally important that we keep understanding this principle and keep establishing its relevance to our lives. And 1 Corinthians, the 10th chapter, I would remind you that verse 11 says, of the examples of these stories that we're reading in Israel and the ones that he's mentioned there, that they are written for our instruction. They happened as an example to us, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Now look at verse 13. No temptation has overtaken you but such as is common to man. Your case nor mine is special. The same things that you face and that I face, everyone has or will face. We're not a special case. Don't try to justify yourself on special case logic. Secondly, God is faithful who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able. What that says to me, correct me if I'm wrong, that when I succumb to temptation and fail, it's my fault. God didn't place something before me or allow something to be placed before me that I could not handle with His help. Now, I may have had to, like Paul, rely on God. When Paul prayed for the removal of the thorn in the flesh, he was told, my power is sufficient. My grace is enough for you. And Paul, by relying on that grace and on that power, was able to say, I'm well content with weaknesses. So when we look at this text and it says God is faithful and will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're capable, that means when I fail in my temptations, it's my fault. Thirdly, and more to our point here, but with the temptation will provide you the way of escape also that you may be able to endure it. What I think that third point means is that God is never going to allow us nothing but wrong choices. There's going to always be a right thing to do. Now, understand from our text here in 1 Samuel 13. He waited 7 days. When did the day end for Hebrews? Sunset. Was it dark yet? You see, Saul waited until it was the seventh day. He didn't wait at all the seventh day because Samuel says, I'll be there in 7 days. After daybreak, it's the seventh day, Saul starts getting nervous. Did he wait until the end of the day? Apparently not, because as soon as he offered the sacrifices, Samuel shows up. There was a right thing to do. But we have to be patient. We can't get nervous and excited, overly so, and say, well, I've got to do something. No, what you may have to do is wait and trust and obey. Now you take that and apply it however you think appropriate to our current situation in this and other countries of the world. But our circumstances cannot be allowed to enable us to see that ourselves as victims or to portray ourselves to others as victims. The way of escape that Paul talks about to the Corinthians may be the most difficult, hard, gut-wrenching thing that you've ever done in your life. But it's there. What we have to do is wait, be patient, and look for, find, and take that way of escape that God provides us. It may not be easy to see. It may not be easy to find. It certainly will not be easy necessarily always to take, but it's always there. It's always available. So God's not going to leave you with nothing but wrong choices. Stop seeing yourself as a victim of circumstances. Fourthly, finally, and quickly, we need to stop seeing ourselves as victims of other people's failures. Well, if he or she hadn't have done this or that, then I wouldn't have done this or that. Or the other. We see this a lot. If he or she had done what he or she was supposed to have, then I wouldn't have reacted the way that I did. Well, wait a minute. Let's be clear. You're not accountable for their actions, but you are accountable for your reactions regardless of what their actions may or may not have been. We are always accountable for ourselves, for how we react. Moses' patience was surely tried by the weakness and the sinfulness of Israel in the wilderness. In Numbers, the 20th chapter, they're bellyaching again to Moses. They're rejecting Moses and Aaron. And Moses loses his temper. Once. God told him to speak to the rock. And Moses said, "Must we fetch water for you, miserable people, from this rock?" And he struck the rock. And because of that, Moses was not allowed entrance into the promised land. Don't get ahead of me. That doesn't mean Moses wasn't allowed to go to heaven. Moses was prevented from entering the thing that he had worked for 2/3 of his life. Getting these people to the promised land. He himself was not allowed to go. Moses' patience was surely tried. But it was because of his failure to react in the right way and do what God said that prevented him from entering the promised land. Read one passage with me from Romans 12 and then we're done. In Romans, the 12th chapter, look at verse 17 and following. Never pay back evil for evil to anyone. What's he talking about? The reaction. Is he condemning the evil that someone else has done to you? Well, no, not necessarily, other than just calling it evil. What he's saying is that you can't respond in an analogous way. Never pay back evil to anyone. Respect what is right in the sight of all men. If possible, so far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. Never take your own revenge. So when we say, "I just couldn't help myself," if they hadn't have done that, then I'd have been okay. But when they did that, I just lost it. Yeah, you did. You lost control of self. You lost obedience to God. And for that, we must all be accountable. He goes on in the text. Never take your own revenge, beloved, but leave room for the wrath of God, for it is written, "Vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. But if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him drink. For in so doing, you will heap burning coals upon his head." There's always a right thing to do. It's not to respond in kind to the evil that someone has done to us, but it is to do the right thing, as this text says. To respond to evil with good. Now look at verse 21. Do not be overcome by evil. And if we react to evil with evil, by doing evil ourselves, regardless of how we may view it or portray it to someone else, we're not victims of what someone else does to us. We only become that when we allow what they do to us to change us. Can somebody blacken my eye? Yes. Does that make me a victim? Yeah, I guess, in some senses. But that doesn't mean that I have to remain in that state and allow that to dominate my life. I get to choose how I'm going to respond, not only to that person, but to myself in those circumstances. I'm responsible for how I react. The conclusion, therefore, is very simple. The choice, as always, is ours. We can see and play ourselves off as victims of genetics, of chance, of circumstances, of other people's failures, or for whatever else that we can imagine and stick into that box. Or we can listen to, we can trust, and we can obey God. Accepting responsibilities and correcting our mistakes as best we can, and depending on God's grace and God's mercy and God's strength for the rest.
which it will it be for you? Are you going to view yourself as a victim or as victorious through Christ Jesus? That's the ultimate choice that we have to make, is it not? Victimhood or victory? If we can help you this morning in some way to be right with God and attain to that victory, whether coming back to Him and asking for the forgiveness of sins and prayers of the congregation, or coming to Christ for the first time and laying it all at His feet and says, "I have sinned. Cleanse me. Make me whole in the blood of the Lamb." Can we help you? If so, come while we stand and while we sing.